Good afternoon. Welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Good parenting certainly benefits from a knowledge of the stages of physical, verbal, cognitive, emotional, and social development of children and adolescents. It helps to have an insight regarding behavior change. And, oh yeah, patience helps a little bit as well. If you could use a little help, why not listen today as we discuss parenting on Line 1. Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, your host today. And Anchorage, if you've got questions, call us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1@kska.org. My guest today is family therapist, parent educator, and author Susan Stiffelman. Susan has got a degree in developmental psychology from the University of Redlands in California and a master's degree in clinical psychology at Antioch University. She's also a marriage and family therapist and has recently written a book, Parenting Without Power Struggles. Welcome to Line 1.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here with you.
It's wonderful to have somebody talking about parenting again. I think it's one of the most common as I said beforehand, I think of it as a chronic disease, so it's something a lot of us adults have to put up with and go through, and it requires a lot of expertise. My understanding is your book kind of makes it tries to simplify this as a very complicated subject.
Yes, I do try to simplify it, and I think that when you boil it down, there's just a few things that can make a tremendous difference in whether a child cooperates with you and, you know, more importantly, whether they grow up to feel strong in who they are and resilient enough to tackle whatever life might throw their way as an adult.
So, yeah, after all, it's got an end point, and that's allowing children to move on ahead on their own after you've kind of helped them develop certain characteristics. Is that one way to look at parenting?
It's a really great way to look at it. One of the things that I often say is that we're actually not raising children, we're raising adults. And we lose sight of that. We forget that, you know, this isn't just about today and getting through this week or whatever. It's really about equipping a child with what they're going to need to have a successful and fulfilling and enjoyable adult life, which is where they're ideally, hopefully, going to spend the most of their visit here on the planet.
Your book uses, power struggles in the format of talking about parenting. What you want to expand on why you chose that title?
I chose that title because many parents, you know, when I look at the complaints, I do a lot of workshops and, of course, counseling and now a lot of telephone coaching, and I would say that if there's a common thread, it has to do with how do I get my child to, you know, whatever it is, brush their teeth, do their homework, cooperate, fill, you know, take out the trash, be nice to their brother. And in many respects, this is sort of reflected with power. Who has the power? Who's calling the shots? So while my point isn't that you win the power struggle, my point is that you avoid having them in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how do you do that?
Well, think of it. First thing I want to do is imagine that you and I were in the same room, and I asked you to face me, and we put our hands palm to palm so that we're facing each other and our palms are pressed against each other, and I begin pushing against you. What would you do?
Push back.
Yeah, that's your instinct. That's your instinct. Mm-hmm. And I've done this with thousands of people, and that's what they typically will do. If you come at a child, so you're pushing against them, you're kind of awakening their instinct to push back. So the first piece that I teach is how to come alongside a child rather than coming at them. And that we can, you know, we have a nice amount of time here so we can talk about the specifics of that. But that's really one of the fundamental bits about avoiding a power struggle is that you don't come at a child, you come alongside them. The second piece, and this is another image, I'm sort of a visual person. If you imagine, if you put your hands in two fists and you put your right hand in front of you and that represents you as the parent and then your left hand will represent the child. So you put the right hand above the left hand out in front of you. that represents the hierarchy that's meant to be. So that's the parent in charge, the parent on top. And that might be, let's say the child says, well, can I have another piece of cake? Okay? And you as the parent may have decided it's not a good idea. So you say, well, honey, I'm afraid not. Now the child says, well, why not? Which they're likely to do because kids, you know, want to experience as much enjoyment and pleasure as possible. And this is the operative thing. If you then say, because you won't eat your dinner, because, you know, it might give you a tummy ache, whatever that reason is, and the child's upset, imagine now that instead of your right hand being above the child's, the two hands are side by side. Who's in charge when the two hands are side by side?
Right.
Nobody.
Right.
And so that's where you have the pushing and the power struggle. That's where you would start, you know, debating and negotiating about the cake. And then there's a third way that the hands can go, which is the child's hand above yours. And now the child's saying, well, if you don't let me have the cake, I'm not going to eat my dinner. And now your hand is down below theirs, and you're saying things like, well, if you don't eat your dinner, you're not going to get to watch TV or whatever it is, because now you're below the child. And you're definitely in the power struggle. And one of the quickest ways of knowing that you're down below the child and that they're calling the shots is that you're bribing and threatening.
One other thing that I think from my point of view as a pediatrician to someone is that each child is also different, though. Some are more likely to push back and push back more consistently and harder than another child. So we often hear about the ones that are a little bit more difficult.
That's true, but, you know, my approach is a little bit different. I'm interested in why a child even, you know, yes, it's true that temperaments can be different and varied, but but typically when a child is chronically difficult, I want to get underneath that because my belief is that there's a reason.
Right, right. Okay.
And that we can be Sherlock Holmes, or I sort of do it the way you do with Jeopardy. If whining is the answer, what is the question? So a child who's chronically difficult, yes, to some degree we see, for instance, the ADD-ish kids or kids with impulse problems, they may be a little bit harder to manage or they may be, you know, more predictably difficult. But I'm not convinced that that's just a function of a child's temperament. I think that kids, you know, human beings are actually wired to resist coercion. We're wired to resist being bossed around. That's a good thing, actually, because it prevents your little 2 or 3 year old from wandering off with a stranger who says, come with me. But the catch to that is that we're wired to resist being bossed around outside of attachment and connection. And so when I have a child who's chronically difficult, chronically resistant or defiant, then I'm also not exclusively, but I'm going to be looking at taking the temperature, so to speak, of the connection that that child feels with the parent or the caretaker, because, you know, one of the ways that we know things are off track with certain kids is that they misbehave. So if you rekindle a strong connection and attachment, and I talk about the 6 stages of attachment in a child's life, then you have a child whose instinct to cooperate is rekindled, and they're more naturally likely to do what you ask and go along with the plan.
Remind our listeners again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Susan Stiffelman. She's a parent educator and recently written a book on parenting that's kind of a how-to and hopefully very, very simple way for parents to get a handle on this. We'll talk about it. Her website where you can get some advice by telephone or by some email courses or internet courses. So please don't hesitate to give us a call. Our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as usual, you can email during the program at lineone, lineone at kska.org. There is a thought that you've brought up. It's like these persistent kids are in a sense, you're saying responding like there's some other problem there, and you're trying to get at the bottom of it. From a pure behavioralist point of view, you would say, or I might say, that if there's a behavior that doesn't change, there's a underlying reinforcement for it. I hear some of that in what you're saying.
Yes, yes. You know, in a child's first 6 years of life, they go through, you know, Neufeld has described these six stages, and I love the model. And each of those stages, basically in the first year and the second and so forth until the child's six, and then, but those stages get recycled throughout their life, meaning that you're constantly deepening and strengthening the attachment between the parent and the child. When a child is really solidly and securely connected and attached to the parent, meaning that they feel close, they feel seen, they feel cherished as they are, they feel that there's an overlap of interests, all kinds of things. They feel the parent, a mutual sense of loyalty and belonging. When those things are in place, you naturally have a child who kind of wants to please you. Think about it. The only reason children do what you ask is because they want to please you. Because more often than not, the things we ask our kids to do are not things they particularly want to do. So the flip side of that is that when you have a child who chronically and predictably doesn't want to do what you ask, I'm going to be looking at, among other things, I'm going to be looking at the depth and strength of the attachment between the parent and the child. And it's really easy to strengthen, and it's amazing how quickly a child's behavior will turn around. I can tell you story after story of kids who were belligerent, resistant, defiant, and the parent started, you know, sometimes it's when they've taken this, I do a 30-day class, sometimes it's reading the book and really making an effort to apply it, but whatever they do something to really shift things, and the child just almost miraculously starts to be more compliant and cooperative.
The other comment that I'd say is when I heard you talking about that perspective of having coming along with the child instead of pushing each other, it makes me think of the word nurturing versus maybe the typical way we think about parenting is a response to discipline and something the child wants to do.
Yeah, children, if you're my son and I say, you got to get going on your homework right now. Or let's try another one. Imagine that you're my son and you come to me and you say, I don't like school. Okay? So you want to role play that with me for a minute?
Okay. Yeah. Okay, I'm tired of going to school. I don't want to go this morning.
All right. Now, what do you think, Dr. Woodard? What do you think the typical parent will say to that?
Pretty much, you've got to go, or perhaps maybe what's the problem, but something like
but
that.
But typically it's going to be, you got to go, and here's the reason. Now, here's the way I talk about that.
Okay.
I'll do the role play in a minute.
All right.
The way I talk about this is that most parents parent from what I call Act 2, meaning Act 2 parenting would be, well, you got to go, or too bad, or come on, it'll be fun once you get there. Those are all Act 2 comments. And Act 2, there's a time and a place for it, don't get me wrong, but until a child has had their Act 1, meaning that they're receptive to what you want to tell them, they're not going to really absorb the wisdom that you might share with them in Act 2. So Act 2 is really directed to a child's left brain, which is language-based, it's analytical, logical, all those things. And when a child is upset, they're really over in their right brain, which is much more feeling, it's more emotional, it's more sensing. And so what I talk about in my work in terms of coming alongside them is giving them what I call an Act 1. And Act 1 even has a theme song in my model, and the theme song is, what is it like to be you? And when you give a child an Act 1, especially if they're upset, you prepare them for whatever things you might have to say that are more logical or linear. So Act 1 is slower, it's more thoughtful, and in Act 1 I'm also going to be asking questions or making comments to the child that get them to nod their head or say yes at least three times, because what do we know about a child who's nodding his head when you're listening, when you're saying things about them?
I'm probably not listening, just trying to get you to leave them alone and let you move on.
Well, that's one possibility, but the other is that when you're listening, if you're my child and I'm uh-huh. saying things and you're nodding your head, there's a good chance that you feel like I'm hearing you. And I'm understanding you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So when a child feels that we're hearing and understanding them, and then we're not just rushing in, coming at them with our own agenda, but we're actually listening and understanding what's going on for them, they lower their guard and they become more open to what we might then have to mm-hmm. say in a minute or two.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, I'm going to do a little demonstration with you.
Okay.
So you'll be my son now, and you can go ahead and tell me.
Yeah, I don't want to go this morning. I'm tired. It's not fun. I'm done enjoying going to school.
Oh, sweetie. So you just wish you could stay home, huh?
Yeah, yeah. I think that would be the most appealing thing for me to do today.
Yeah, I can imagine. Do you sometimes just feel really tired of going every day?
You bet.
Yeah, that's got to be hard when you wake up and you're just wishing you could stay cozy in your bed, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, boy, honey. Yeah. Oh, that's rough. So now, as the child, do you think that you feel differently from me saying, well, you got to go?
All right. Yeah, no doubt about it. Yeah, I'm having a hard time fighting back with you here.
Well, yeah, I'm not giving you anything to push against,
right.
And I'm not pushing against
right.
you. It doesn't mean you're not going to school, and it
right.
doesn't mean, by the way, that I'm going to have this conversation with you every single morning.
Right.
In fact, it's just as likely that I'll have this conversation with you in the evening after a particularly rough morning and say, you know, I have a feeling this morning was kind of rough for you. What was that like for you having to go to school when you wanted to stay home? And so it doesn't mean that I'm going to do this in the midst of trying to get my son to the car. It means that I'm giving him the chance to let me know what's going on for him. And I'm keeping my right hand above his, meaning I'm not engaging in the power struggle of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm holding my place as what I call the captain of the ship in his life. The captain of the ship analogy it really runs through my book, and I came up with that because I had this image. Imagine that you're on a cruise and you're sort of having a nice dinner with the captain, and suddenly you hear the whoop, whoop, the alarm, all over the ship, and you see the captain just completely freaking out or pulling out his hair or jumping overboard. You would be very distressed.
Yep.
So we need, our children need to see that we can handle whatever they're going through, whatever obstacle, challenge, frustration, and that we don't, figuratively jump overboard when they say or do something that isn't quite what we had in mind.
All right. I'm going to maybe hopefully give you an example, another chance to use this example, and we'll take one of our callers. Sue, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a caretaker of four-year-old children, and I try to spend time with a child who chronically hits, slaps, spits, and hurts other children. I try to spend time with him when he first comes into my classroom, but he just continues to hurt children. I was wondering if you could give me some ideas.
Well, thank you for your question. I'm glad that you called. Can you roll the footage back? Like, Matt, take that moment when he walks in and starts to hit. And if you were to rewind the film, what would you see going on? Is this a child who's hungry? Is he, playing with kids much older than him? What are the situations going on before the hitting that would almost make the hitting the logical outcome?
Well, there doesn't seem to be a lot of rhyme and reason to it. From my point of view, it can be during transition times. It can be if somebody's too close to him. He's very sensitive, face sensitive, and so we try to make sure he is. Got plenty of space between the other children, like if they're lining up to go to the bathroom and things like that.
Uh-huh.
But quite often, it's just so quick. It's very impulsive. It's very quick.
Wow.
And he, you know, I'll say, you know, I'll have him look at the child and say, look, you know, this person's crying. And
that's not going to be at all useful.
Yeah, I don't know really what to do. We've tried timeout. We've tried thinking chair. We've tried looking
yeah.
at the other child who's hurt. You know, go get them ice. You know, they're, you know, you hit them in the head with the toy. We've tried calming down techniques and things like that. I don't know. I'm kind of at my wit's end.
Well, you know, one of the things I would say is that the reason those things don't work is mm-hmm. that they're all directed at his left brain, his logical brain, and they also presume that he has the ability, before he acts on the impulse to hit, that he has a gap where he can think, yeah, gosh, I really want to hit this little boy, but remember last time I got scolded for it. A child who has significant impulse problems doesn't have that gap. So,
no.
In other words, there's the impulse and there's the acting on it, and there's no in-between, you
mm-hmm.
know. And so thinking that having him, you know, talking to him about how the other child feels, that's a left brain approach. When he's all stirred up, he doesn't really have a left brain, so to speak.
Okay.
So, honestly, children, you know, the brain develops from back to front, and we know that the prefrontal cortex, which is the area behind the forehead, is largely responsible for impulse control. And so, for instance, I work a lot with what I call ADD-ish children. I'm not really fond of the label, but I do work with that population that have those characteristics. And quite often, you'll see about a 30% developmental lag or delay in that child in terms of organization, impulse control, and the like, meaning that if you've got a 12-year-old, in certain respects, he's more like an 8-year-old. So if you're talking about a 4-year-old, you're talking about a child with the impulse control responses of a toddler, really. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, completely, yes.
Yeah. Yes. So you would never talk to your, you know, 20-month-old or your 26-month-old and say, now, how do you think the other little boy felt when you did that?
Right. Okay.
So my advice to you would really be to step back from what you think it should be like, because a lot of us trip over what I call our snapshot child. Imagine in your right hand you've got the snapshot of what this little boy should do and how he should behave. We all do this with our kids. You know, my snapshot child does his homework the first time I ask. He cleans, you know, he clears the table. He does all these great things. Well, then you've got the real child. And your snapshot child is 4 years old and, quote, should be able to, right,
mm-hmm.
whatever, fill in the blank. But the sooner that you get a handle on who the child actually is,
okay.
the better equipped you're going to be what I call the captain of the ship. And then the captain of the ship really sets up that child's environment. To some extent, you've already started not having kids get so close to him, but
mm-hmm.
really recognizing who he is and isn't right now. I would leave aside all the rationalizations and, you know, explaining and all that, because it's not going to take him anywhere.
Okay.
And I hope that helps.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Oh, good. Okay.
Thanks for your call, Sue.
Thank you.
Remind everyone again, if you have questions or comments, there's a couple of ways to get a hold of us. You can email us at line1@kska.org. Our local number, 550-8433. And our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And the questions, Susan, that I had put down, I wanted to kind of just stumble on to childhood eating problems again, because I think it's such an important issue, especially with the issue about obesity. But we had an email that has come in that talks about really finicky eaters and how she approaches that. She says she puts down some smaller dishes with just small bites on it so the child can
right.
empty one thing at a time. And she wonders if that's a good way to deal with the finicky eater, as she says.
I think that's a great way to do that and to not make it matter so much. I mean, there are children that are what we call mono eaters. You know, they have about three things that they eat. And as long as they're basically getting the nutrition that they need or you're able to supplement it, I think it's fine. You know, what we really don't want to do with a child is make food a big deal, make it a big issue. That's where we know that some of the roots of eating disorders in later life show up, is that in childhood it became a real battle to, you know, be forced to eat things. There's also a lot of evidence, and I'm sure you've seen this in your practice, that, you know, children that are more sensitive, that have, you know, they're just more sensitive, that taste and texture and all those things just impact them more profoundly than they do an average child. So it's helpful to just find out what works for the child. I think small bites and small portions are helpful. Also, it can be helpful for a parent to involve the child in menu planning or in cooking and adding ingredients, so that you start edging into weaving in new foods, maybe with the child's involvement in using those in recipes, so that they begin to sort of take the foray into trying something new. But I wouldn't push it. I think she's doing just fine by small portions, small bites, and not making a big deal about it.
Okay, good. Thanks for your advice on that. I'm going to go ahead and take our break at this point. We've got a couple of people that are holding on phone calls. I think the most appropriate thing is to get our break out of the way, and then we'll come back and address those. So you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection in Anchorage. You can reach us again at 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And remember our email address, line1@kska.org. After this brief break, we'll come back and continue to take your calls and emails while we discuss family therapy and parenting with Susan Stiffelman on Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line 1, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line 1 will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our guest today is a family therapist and parent educator, Susan Stiffelman. She's the author of Parenting Without Power Struggles. If you've got questions or comments, you can email us at line1@kska.org. Call us at 550-8433 or our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening to the program between 8 and 9, you're listening to a rebroadcast, so you'll have to make your phone calls and emails right during the next hour before 3 o'clock. Rhonda, you're on line 1. What can we do for you?
Yes, I was wondering if the doctor is familiar with parent alienation in relationship to child custody and divorce, and if there's a good specialist in Anchorage that is, able to diagnose that, or if that is easy to diagnose.
Yes. First, one of the things I'd say, Ron, Susan is in California, so she's not going to be familiar with what's going on in Anchorage-wise. But so it's parent alienation, though, while dealing with divorce, she said?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. All right.
I'll listen.
All right. All right, Susan.
Thank you, Rhonda, for your question. I was wondering, could you phrase that as a question, because people use those terms sort of to mean different things. Could you ask a specific question rather than just using the terms themselves?
I think she hung up, so
okay.
she's listening offline.
Then I'll speak just in. Are you there, Rhonda?
No. She may call back while we're talking.
Okay,
but
well,
I'll
speak
ahead.
In general terms.
All right.
The way I understand those terms, and I wanted to be sure that we were in sync, that there are situations where a parent has had little connection or interface with a child, And you could say that they're alienated from the child. And then, of course, when it gets involved with divorce, I'm shooting from the hip here because I don't know exactly what her question was. But I'm guessing that it may have to do with what do you do when a child is being kind of mandated to spend time with a parent with whom they don't really have any kind of a strong connection or attachment. Okay. And if that is your question, Rhonda, or even if it isn't and you'd like to call back and clarify, you're more than welcome to do so. But I can say in general terms that if a parent is fighting for custody and presumably it's not just to get back at the other parent or to punish them, but it's because they genuinely want to have a connection with their child, then I have many times seen that in a strange way, divorce can help repair a connection between a child and a parent insofar as there is now more frequent contact. And that doesn't mean, however, that the transition, especially if a child is alienated from the parent and has had little contact, it needs to be handled quite gently and gingerly because just because someone is biologically a parent doesn't mean that the child feels that sense that they are, you know, safe and secure. And that is something I would hope that you would find someone to work with who can help kind of set that up, you know, in a mediated way so that the child is gently brought back into the parent's life.
And I would mention, Rhonda, if you're listening, that within the last month, a couple of weeks ago, we had a program with Kathy Von Hippel, a child psychologist here in Anchorage and an attorney who was really just dealing with these whole issues about children and divorce. And if you go to our website, you'll see some links to information about what's going on in town regarding that. So let's do another phone call. Let's take Kevin on line one. Kevin, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
How you doing, Dr. Woodard? And thank you for having the show around parenting. It's a powerful message. I'm very interested in finding out Susan's approach on the concepts around choices and consequences as a way to approach children, in instead of getting tied up in that power struggle, that you approach children saying, well, these are the choices, which do you choose? And in other words, giving them the power to make the choice, but attaching the consequences, either positive or negative, to their choices.
Okay, good question.
Thank you. That's a great question. And yes, I'm a great believer in really not using threats or bribes to coerce a child, but rather, you know, at the same time, not preventing them from bumping up against the real-life consequence of their actions or their choices. A lot of that, of course, is going to depend on the child's age, so that, you know, there are times where it's just not appropriate to give a child a choice, of course, if there's danger or some kind of risk involved. And I talk a lot about something in my book. I talk about this wall of futility, meaning, and this is, again, Neufeld's term, it's a wonderful concept where when a child is frustrated about something, there are really only two outcomes. There's only two ways that that frustration can roll out. One is that they will adapt, and in many respects you can use the model of grieving, you know, that they will move through their denial and their anger and bargaining and sadness, and eventually they will adapt to not getting the new toy or having to go to school after all, or whatever the frustration is, or they'll be aggressive. So the two outcomes for frustration are either aggression or adaptation. And many times we parents are so distressed by our child's unhappiness or frustration that we jump in and fix things for them, thinking that we're loving them and parenting them. But the truth is, Mother Nature knows what she's doing, and children are supposed to get frustrated every day. They're supposed to encounter challenges. That's how they develop the muscle of resilience. And so rather than fixing things for a child who's frustrated, I talk a lot about helping them hit the wall of futility, hit that moment, in other words, when they experience, wow, I'm really not going to get what I wanted. And in some cases, that would mean if you choose this, this is what's going to happen, and if you choose this other thing, then this will happen. But not being so frantically invested in making sure that they pick the one that causes them, you know, some complete guarantee that they won't have any unhappiness. So, sweetheart, if you keep kicking that piece of furniture, you know, I do want you to know that this is what's going to happen, is I think along the lines of what you were saying. The bigger thing, though, too, is that I sort of steer away from the whole thing of consequences in general, even though I'm supportive of what you're saying. My work is much more about avoiding problems than fixing them when they're happening. I think a lot of parenting issues, like the problems that you encounter regularly, can be avoided. And so I use that ship, captain of the ship analogy again. If you're on a ship and for some reason, you know, suddenly you hear the alarm and you find out that the ship has hit an iceberg, you're not going to be happy about that, but you will be comforted if the captain says, you, go there, you know, and you see him taking action and handling it. On the other hand, if your captain hits an iceberg every day, then to me, you know, you want a different captain. And so consequences and punishments are often a result of simply not avoiding a problem that could better be avoided.
Well, I really appreciate that response. I think that you're talking about some of the work that, like, Joan Casey does around drama triangles, where a child will either become the tormented anger person who has this pent up, and then you wind up as a parent, or a parent is quite easily drawn into, for a variety of reasons, becoming the rescuer, and then regretting it and feeling like the victim.
Right.
And it's a bad cycle. And one of the terms that I've seen used a lot with younger children is, it's okay to be angry. It's just not okay to dump it on anyone else.
Yeah.
Creating those safe boundaries for kids to have that. I guess I'm right. Looking at it from when a child has a choice, and they're going to choose something, that I think that does matter. And I think what you said is very appropriate. But parents have to really understand the consequences of their choices as well, and how they work with the kid.
That is so true. That is very true. And, you know, this idea of the wall of futility, I'll just go on and add a little bit about that. The wall of futility basically is sadness. So, in other words, any time that a child's frustrated, or you for that matter, to fully accept the new terms, in other words, you didn't get the job you wanted, or, you know, the bid on the house was turned down, or whatever it is, to fully adapt to something that frustrates you, you actually have to move through the anger into sadness. And it's only when we help our children feel sad and we can handle their sadness, and we're not trying to rush in to fix it with our Act Two advice or, you know, cheerful suggestions, when we can help our children just sit with feeling sad, and especially with a young child, have a good cry, we know that children, after they've had a good cry, they sort of adapt. They feel better. They move on. So that's another piece of that wall of futility that is very important.
Yeah, it's the richness of owning their emotions. That's wonderful.
Yes.
Thank you for your call, Kevin.
All right. Yeah, it's back in my mind of this prevention. I love what you said. It's important for medicine, but it's also important for parenting, is that your efforts are more geared towards kind of keeping these issues from happening, or understanding why they're happening, to keep them from continuing to happen.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So many times when I'm doing a class or a workshop, and a parent will say, gosh, you know, what should I do? My child this morning just had this huge blow up when I was getting him off to school. And when I ask the question, well, is that the first time? You know, typically, no, it's something that happens on a daily basis. Or I'll give the analogy of, you know, you have a little brother in the backseat of the car, and you're driving the older sister off to soccer practice. And the little brother in the backseat starts messing with the window. And you say, you know, Bobby, stop playing with the window. And Bobby keeps messing with the window. And you say, Bobby, Mommy wants you to stop that now. And he rolls the window down, and he rolls the window up, and keeps at it. And finally, you know, with great drama, you pull the car over and turn around and scream at him, do you want Mommy to have an accident? You've got to stop. Well, the fact is, you know, you could prevent that problem by captaining your ship. you know, put some things in the back seat of the car for little Bobby to play with. Or, you know, there's ways that we just day after day walk into the same problematic scenario without shifting anything that might make that problem solved.
Good. Lisa, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. Are you there?
Yep, sure.
Hi, Lisa.
Oh, okay, excellent. I'm sorry. Okay, yeah, I just wanted to share a couple things. First of all is I think that kids really are so much brighter than people give them credit for being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But especially little kids, they really only see things in black and white. And I used to babysit two kids here in the town I live in, and they were really difficult. Nobody wanted to babysit them. You know, I actually got tapped for the job right after I moved here. And they were incredibly difficult. Their parents were going through a really nasty divorce. Sometimes they stayed with their grandma, and they were just out of control. And one day when they were just being out of control, I looked at them and I said, you know what? I said, maybe your dad lets you act this way. I said, maybe when you're at your mama's house, she lets you act this way. Maybe your grandma lets you act this way. But right now, I'm here, and in my world, nobody acts this way. You act like real people. You don't act like little animals. You act like real people. And I want you to do this, and I want you to do that. And that's how I want you to act when you're in my world. And you know what? They totally behaved after that. I never had one iota worth of problem with them.
Mm. Well, what you did using the model that I use is you had your right hand above the left. You just owned your role as being in charge.
Well, that's it. You know, it's like, look, and you know, I was able to help them, and so they didn't feel like I was really stepping on them saying, well, you have to behave this way. You know, this is always wrong when you do this. It's like, hey, if you want to do that everywhere else, you can do that. But with me, you're not going to do that.
And you know what? I'm going to venture
parent,
a guess.
Excuse me?
Go ahead.
Oh no! I was just gonna say I raised a son, and I always did that with him too. You know, it's like when you're here and you're around adults, you're gonna act in this certain way, and that's the way it's gonna be. You know, he never threw a tantrum in a restaurant because the one time that he did, you know, I paid for the meal and I got up and we left because I wasn't gonna have him disrupting the whole world. And after that, when he knew that if he behaved a certain way, okay, mom's going to pay for it, we're going to get up, you're going to go home, and how come I got toast, mom? Well, because you didn't act properly when we were in the restaurant.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one piece of it, and we do have to understand, and I think we were talking about this earlier, Dr. Woodard, that every child has their own temperament. They have their own challenges, their own personality and quirks and baggage. One thing I'm guessing that you did, whether you're aware of it or not, is in addition to sort of very clearly affirming that you were in charge, I bet you also did things with those children that let them really feel that you saw and enjoyed who they were, because that's
absolutely
the other piece. And you see,
absolutely,
children, when they feel seen, it's like feeding a plant deeply with the water and nourishment that they need. So another,
what a difference it makes. Plus, also talking to them like they're people and not like their chairs or something, you know?
There you go. Great. Thank you. Thanks for your call.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it, Lisa. All right, Susan, here's a real one, I think an important one that came in by email. I'm going to read most of it. So it's kind of a somewhat lengthy, but email. It says, this morning my 14-year-old surprised my husband and I with a pierced lip. She did it to herself last night with an earring. We were surprised and are struggling with how to deal with this issue. She told me about a month ago she wanted to do it, and we discussed that we would allow this to happen this summer by a professional. Obviously, she couldn't or wouldn't wait until the summer and now has a hole in her lip. I made her take it out, but I'm definitely open to letting her get it done properly, but I also want to get to the root of the problem of why she did it on her own. I'm struggling with the appropriate discipline for the behavior or if I should do anything at all. I want her to come to us with her problems, but I don't want to just ignore it. So we're concerned about the health and sanitary issues as well as struggling with the issue of her trying to hide it from us. Do you have any suggestions?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I would do, just whether or not, and I'm not a doctor, so you can weigh in on this, but to me, not only for health reasons, but just to make a sort of a statement, I would take her to a doctor and have it looked at, because it is a serious thing, and you know, is there a question even in terms of self-mutilation? I mean, you know, that's a pretty severe thing to do to yourself, and I'm curious and concerned about the level of pain and how she managed that, and so I would definitely want to have a physician look at her. Separate from that, I think I would, before I got too wrapped up in what punishment, I would really want to get underneath this and say, you know, honey, that was a really big thing that you did, not only because you knew that we had told you not to do that yet, but you did something that would have had to cause you a pretty big amount of pain and discomfort. And what was going on for you? Like, talk to us. Tell me about that. So I, rather than jumping right in with the shouting and the threats and all that, I would really want to know, what did it mean to her to get that lip pierced? And my concern is that she's at sort of the prime age for peer influence. I would be very interested in knowing or being reassured that she's spending time with good kids. And I would want to look at the bigger picture here in terms of what motivated her to not only go against your instructions, but to do something that had to have been, you know, scary and painful. And the conversation to me would be, what was going on for you that prompted you to do that?
Yeah, supportive, but interested in what led to this.
Yeah, because to me, this is a symptom of something potentially much more serious than just the lip.
Yeah, know? It may be more than just peer pressure.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I would agree. And certainly there's some risk of infection. And, the issue is more than just discipline. It's trying to understand what the circumstances are.
Yep. That's such a tricky age. And, you know, was she altered? Was she drunk or on something? Who knows? You know, was she with other kids? Have kids been excluding her? Is she making an effort to feel she belongs? Is she in some kind of a, you know, are these Facebook friends? I mean, there's just so many possibilities that are affecting kids today that really are even new from 10 years ago that...
Mm-hmm. I come back to this comment. You're coming along with her, trying to help her understand her and what you'd said earlier, and being supportive, and but just trying to understand what's driving, what her feelings are.
Yeah.
Okay, good. I want to give you a chance to talk about how people can get a hold of you. We have a link to your website, but what you're doing, how people might take advantage of you.
Thank you. Well, yes, my website is passionateparenting.net, and I have this great book that people are really enjoying, Parenting Without Power Struggles, Raising Joyful, Resilient Kids While Staying Cool, Calm, and Connected. The book is, you know, an easy read. People are telling me that it's, you know, it's very user-friendly, but I really wanted to do more than just write a book, and what I've come up with right now is a 30-day class that is very affordable, and it offers parents more of a structured, supportive way of changing in a month, you know, in a really fundamental way. The class basically is email-based and comes to you, and you just get an email every day with a worksheet or an assignment or a task or a challenge or a video or a phone call with me. And it's a way to get a lot of structured support to make changes. I also do, I speak all over the country, so I'm always interested in being invited to come and speak at various locations for parenting groups or churches or temples or organizations. And then I do phone coaching. So if you go to my website, you can literally buy 15 minutes or half hour, 45 minutes, an hour of time where you can call and just get specific help or even email me a question about your situation with a child. And that also I've tried to price quite affordably so people can get some personalized support and help. I have a column on AOL's Parent Dish where people can submit questions there, although there's a long backlog there, but you can certainly read what I've had to say there and in other places as well. My website really has all the links to the things that I'm up to and how parents can reach me. They can even order the book at that site as well, and passionateparenting.net, and the phone number is 310-589-7020. It's 310-589-7020.
Okay. And let me just remind listeners, you can go to KSKA.org /line1, and you can get to the link of Susan's website as well. Susan, let's move up towards adolescence in a sense a little bit more. And you've talked about how you can help protect kids against depression and peer pressure. We had a little hint of maybe that with that email. What else should we know?
Well, first of all, it's difficult to be a child at any time, but this time, I mean, I think you've seen it as well. Our kids are just bombarded with outside influences, and it's not easy. It's certainly not easy growing up with all the pulls and pushes, you know, of society. And even if you live in a wonderful, sort of, you know, lovely place, our kids, most kids these days, are exposed to all kinds of things just by being on the internet. So the biggest piece, really, in terms of preventing depression, anxiety, and spiraling out of control in other ways, is to allow your child to recognize you as a safe haven and to know in their bones that whatever they're going through, they can talk with you about it. What we see about depression is that kids internalize and they feel that I can't tell you how many teenagers I've worked with, or younger than that actually, who suffer from depression and who are just closed down. They're walled up. They, you know, you ask them what's wrong and they say nothing. And you'll say, well, come on, you know, talk to me about it. And they say, no, forget it. But more often than not, they've learned that it's not a good idea to tell us what they're going through because we act to them. We do the act to all the time. So they say, I don't know, I just don't feel like I have any friends. And the first thing we'll say is, well, honey, you have lots of friends. Or they'll say, you know, I just feel really stupid, you know, and the parent will say, well, you're not stupid. If you just try a little harder, you'd be getting great grades. And we do this act too, and we basically, for all intents and purposes, we're saying to them, I can't handle that you're upset. I need you to feel better right away, so I'm going to try and fix it. And we sort of convey to our kids that if they're troubled or struggling, we're not going to do much of anything useful except try and fix it. And what a child needs to help prevent them from, you know, experimenting with drugs, depression, all these things that we want to help avoid, we really need them to know that we can handle anything. You know, bring it on, honey. I'm your best bet. I'm your North Star. I'm the captain of the ship. Whatever you're going through, I can handle it. Talk to me. We'll get through it.
We're moving into our last 5 minutes, just to remind you where we are. But I have another question I think is pertinent along this line. Is the parent who's listening, reading, thinking, and saying, you know, gosh, I need to change. I need to come to date. I need to understand where I've been wrong. And can I do this? Can I get back in control or become the captain, as you put it?
Yes, yes, yes. In fact, I mean, I've worked with parents in their 70s who have changed the way they parent their kids in their 50s. It's never too late. It just isn't ever too late.
Some hints?
Yeah. Well, it starts with, it starts with understanding that what our kids need most of all from us, and that means a child of any age, is to be seen and cherished as is. I was talking earlier about the snapshot child, and kids know when we're disappointed in who they are or what they are. And, you know, we all try to accept our kids as they are, but we struggle sometimes. You might have pictured getting a child that's, a little in music or a little bit more calm or whatever. I mean, we all have some degree of challenge in, you know, accepting the child that we have. And the more that we can come to terms internally in ourselves with who our child is and who they aren't and make peace with that, sometimes that's even a sort of a grieving process. But the more that you can see a child as they are, let them know how much they light up your world. Let them know what it is about that child, what it is about them that you just love, whether it's, you know, I love your laugh, honey, or nobody tells a joke the way you do. It's letting them feel seen, that the more that you're really feeding who they are at the core. And I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah. It's never too late, because you can do that at any point in a child's life.
In the last couple of minutes, what are the most common issues that parents are asking you about with teenagers in particular?
Oh, with teenagers, it really is either they're already in crisis, meaning the child's shut down, they're using substances, they're sexually promiscuous, they've disengaged, they've withdrawn, they're very rebellious, or they fear that the child's headed in that direction. So I think the issues these days have to do with, well, one in particular is video game addiction. Another, there's always the concern about a child's grades and about their friends and the choices that they're making. Sometimes it's how they're dressing, how late they want to stay out, or at what point do you give them privileges to go out with friends, and trying to navigate this intense transition between childhood and adulthood. And it's definitely tricky, because there's no, you know, right way. There's no one answer. And one of the biggest things I think parents need to do that they're not always that comfortable doing is listening to their own instincts. You know, as much as I feel that I have a lot to say and offer, ultimately, that, you know, what I want parents to do is listen to their own gut and not all the other noises, including their child's, and really trust their instincts about what is right for their child and acting on that bravely.
One last question that sometimes comes up, and that is, do you parent each child the same, or is it do you have to approach each child as different?
You know, there's a lot about it that's the same. I think in many ways we do parent. There's some basic things that I think are universally applicable for raising any child. It's sort of like a plant. All plants need sunlight and water and nourishment, but then just like some plants need more shade and some need more sun and some need more acidy food, I think we do have to see who the child is in front of us, and customize what it is that they in particular need to flourish, and help them uncover their unique gifts and talents and really help them discover who they authentically are, so that they can stand in their genuine version of themselves that will make them the happiest.
Susan, thanks very much for taking the time. I want to encourage you to continue to do this work and encourage our listeners to take advantage of you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Have a good day.
You too.
Line 1 will return next week with state epidemiologist Dr. Joe McLaughlin and Susan Jones, the manager of the Section of Epidemiology, HIV and Sexually Transmitted Disease Program, and we'll be discussing sexually transmitted diseases. I want to also just briefly comment that if you're interested in cross-country skiing with some Olympians this Friday, April 9th from 4 to 7 at the Hilltop Ski Area, you're able to do that courtesy of the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America. Feel free to call 349-0637 for more information. You also can get some information about allergy while you're there. Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.